It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Finds a popular Republican governor challenged by a Democratic candidate in a very blue state. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The current public opinion polls now put Governor Larry Hogan in the 50 percentile range and his Democratic challenger, Ben Jealous, somewhere in the 30s. To say the least, observers see the Democrats' chances as an uphill battle, with even the local state senator Jim Mathias saying he was staying out of the governor's race. So what are Jealous's chances? He joins us this morning in studio. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. It's good to be here with you.
So first of all, started out with the polls. What do you make of the public opinion polls? This is a blue state, but the governor seems pretty popular. I saw his approval rating somewhere around the 60s. What do you make of that? And why do you think that is?
You know, we are running uphill against an incoming governor. Everybody knows who he is. As people get to know my campaign, they hear the message of my campaign, they disproportionately turn to us. Why is that? Because 70% of us know that our lives have not gotten better under Larry Hogan. Everything that should have gone up went down. Everything that should have gone down went up. I mean, just think about it for a second. Our schools have fallen in the national rankings every single year Hogan's been in office. Our murder is up statewide outside of Baltimore City, 42% under Hogan. Healthcare costs have surged 120% under Hogan. That kept me from bringing a factory to South Baltimore from northern Canada because the factory owner said, I just can't locate in a state where your healthcare costs are so unstable. Opioid deaths are up 160%. I was in Talbot County with a little girl, blonde ponytail, coming from tennis practice. All she wanted to talk about were her three classmates whose funerals she had been to in the last 12 months. And then you look at jobs. Jobs, we are stuck everywhere in Maryland. We're dead last in the region in job growth. We're dead last in income growth. If we had the job growth of Virginia during these Hogan years, we would have had 40,000 more jobs right now. But get this, Virginia's job growth is below national average. If we had the their income growth, the average worker would have $8,000 more in our pocket. He wants to talk to you, but he hasn't raised your taxes. Well, he certainly hasn't raised your incomes. Any of ours. And so what do we do in that type of situation? We do what we're doing. We organize community by community. Just with all of the teachers, I'm endorsed by all of the teachers across the entire state, all of the nurses across the state to fix the education system and the healthcare system. And when folks realize there's a Democrat in this race, endorsed by teachers, endorsed by nurses, because we have a plan to finally fully fund our schools and a plan to make sure all of us have healthcare, again, they shift to our campaign disproportionately. So we remain very optimistic.
Let me ask you this, along those lines, State Senator Tim Mathias is running. He's a Democrat and running against a Republican. I interviewed him not too long ago. He says, I'm staying out of the governor's race. There seems to be a distancing going on, certainly on the Eastern Shore. What does that mean in terms of your party and your appeal?
I mean, we've got dozens of folks in the Lower Shore progressives out here in Wicomico this morning, right here in Salisbury, on the doors, knocking on doors. We got families who are up who are excited because they know as a state we can make our community colleges tuition free. We can fix our health care system. We can create thousands of jobs, shifting to clean and renewable energy, helping to stop sea level rise. And those are the conversations that I'm focused on. I have a lot of respect for Senator Mathias. I think many of us do. We also recognize he has to be a bridge in a district that is as conservative as it is in anything else. And I respect him for that. I've spent most of my life being a bridge to civil rights leaders, the president of the NAACP. I was often praised for my ability to bring together Republicans and Democrats to get big things done in areas like criminal justice reform. So he'll run his race. I'll run my race. At the end of the day, what we're both focused on is making sure that we finally fully fund our schools, that everybody has health care they can afford, and we get our economy that Larry Hogan's driven into a ditch unstuck.
Before we get into some of the issues, you also have a fundraising gap, at least as I can tell. Millions and you,
absolutely. But here's the thing.
What do you think? What do you make of that?
Hogan has no advantage right now that Anthony Brown didn't have 4 years ago. And I have no disadvantage right now that Larry Hogan didn't have 4 years ago. Hogan's probably more aware than anybody else. The place I'm in right now is very similar to the place he was in 4 years ago. And so, you know, I'm going to run my race. But let's be clear. If we were sitting here in the primary, we would have a similar conversation. Oh, Mr. Jealous, you've lost every poll. Well, then I won the primary by 10 points, including every county on the Eastern Shore. So You know, we will stick to our knitting. We'll do what we do. We organize our neighbors. We focus on kitchen table issues. And we focus on fully funding our schools, making sure that we pass Medicare for all, that we take on the pharmaceutical companies. And one big difference between me and Mr. Hogan, he takes a whole bunch of money from the pharmaceutical companies that are overcharging all of us. I've made it clear not only will I not take their money or any corporate money, we are solely focused when it comes to health care. First thing we will get done is take on those pharmaceutical companies, get a better price for all of us, put a pricing board in place to prevent them from increasing the rates anymore.
Well, you've talked about a Medicare for all. I'm assuming it's for the state. The thing that I'm reminded of is Romney Care, for instance, Massachusetts, which was the basis of the Affordable Care Act. One of the reasons why that worked so well was because of so much federal funding. Where does the money come from for Medicare for all?
We take the money that we're already using, and we just stretch it further. The problem that we have in this country is that we spend twice as much on healthcare as any other industrialized nation, and we get half as much. And so what you're talking about fundamentally is taking on the pharmaceutical companies to get a better deal, buying in bulk, leveraging the buying power of the people of the state. As a business person, I'm always looking to leverage buying power. And making sure that we cut the overhead, that we cut the excessive management fees. Medicare, the overhead, the management costs are 3%. I have Blue Cross Blue Shield, it's 19%. We know that we can do better. Every other Western nation has. We just have to be willing to take on the corporations that are funding Mr. Hogan's campaign.
Turning to education, you talked about a major increase in salary for the teachers. Again, where does that money come from? Universal pre-K, most of the teacher money comes from the locals, not necessarily from the state.
Two things. Yeah, I've been a CEO since I was 26 years old. I've never met a budget I couldn't optimize by 5%. We are underfunding our schools in Maryland by $2 billion. It sounds like a whole lot of money until you consider our state budget is $44 billion. And fundamentally, in this state, the richest state, and although many places where we live, whether it's on the Eastern Shore, where my family's from in West Baltimore, we may not feel like the richest state. But we are, in fact, the richest state and the richest country on the planet. And so when it comes to education, it's much less, Mr. Rush, that we have a money problem than we have a priority problem. First example of that is the casino money. I mean, think about it. We created hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenues for education, and we ultimately didn't use that to increase funding for education. So what I've said is we will get our priorities straight. We will fund education first. There's a constitutional requirement that we provide a great education for every kid in the Maryland State Constitution. Well, we need to make sure that Maryland State budget reflects that. So you fund education first. And we will also create new revenue sources. The way that we pay for universal full-day pre-K is we legalize cannabis for adult use. It is a drug that is as harmful as alcohol, and we can regulate it like alcohol. And you know what? We're a lot better at regulating alcohol now than we did when Brett Kavanaugh was a kid. And in the process, and by the way, I believe Mr. Hogan may be the only person in America who has no opinion on Brett Kavanaugh. He doesn't have the courage just to tell folks what he thinks. Please, Mr. Hogan, just tell us what you think. But you said he was neither educated enough nor qualified. How is that possible? You're governor. But to have an opinion on Mr. Kavanaugh. Anyways, I digress. We can regulate right. it. And frankly, in the process, make our state safer. They estimate just recently in Baltimore City, there were 11 shootings in one day. The mayor came out and said, we're dealing with a drug war. Police commanders across the state and across the city will tell you there are a lot of shootings related to the marijuana trade in our state. The moment that we legalize it, we take money out of the pockets of gangs and cartels. We put it in the pockets of business people and farmers. And we make our communities wealthier, including we increase tax. We will see increased tax revenues from legalized cannabis enough to fully fund universal pre-K for every 4-year-old in the state. And we need that urgently. The best investment we can make in our future, in our future economy, in our future society, and in the future of our communities is early childhood education. I'm fully committed to getting it done.
Speaking to the opioid epidemic, what are your plans to deal with it as opposed to what we've been doing in the past? I mean, it's easy to be critical of the past. People have been slow on the uptake.
Real
slow. But what are you going to do?
We have to listen to the experts, not the law enforcement experts, the public health experts. Addiction is a public health crisis, and we have to deal with it as such. I have a cousin who's in rehab for heroin right now in another state, and we've all had friends in this state whose families have been shattered by the friendship circles have been shattered by this opioid epidemic. And so what do? We make sure that there are crisis response centers in every corner of the state. Our state's legislative leaders asked for 10. Mr. Hogan funded one. He funded one. He put it in Baltimore City. We need them out here on the Eastern Shore. Again, that girl I spoke to, 13 years old, lost 3 friends. She's in Talbot County. We've got to make sure we have crisis response centers for the opioid epidemic up and down the shore. We got to shift to rehab on demand and make sure that when somebody calls for rehab, there's always a bed. We can do that. We have to take on the opioid tape on these pharmaceutical companies that have turned this crisis really into an epidemic by fanning and fueling and shipping pills in large quantities to places that could never need that many legitimately, and make them pay for the crisis that they've stoked, hold them accountable, drag them into court. We need to set up an office of pain management so that every doctor in Maryland is being trained how to manage pain without relying so heavily on opioids. So there's a range of things that we should be doing. Unfortunately, our current governor likes to pretend that the opioid crisis is as much about incarceration as rehabilitation. It's simply not true. We cannot incarcerate our way out of an addiction crisis. We have to deal with the addiction head on.
Locally, we've had an issue with the Eastern Correctional Institution. We've had, obviously, scandals there.
I've lost a lot of sleep over ECI.
What would you do about it? And where do you think we went wrong?
As a former national president of the NAACP, I've traveled to many corrections facilities in crisis. Never have I seen one in so much crisis, where you literally have protests by the CO's families and protests by the inmates going on simultaneously. What do you do in a situation like that? You take a step back. You make sure that the facility is properly staffed. I've spoken to COs at ECI where they just had one person on the yard with 200 inmates. That's terribly dangerous for everybody, for the officer and for the inmates. We have to take a step back, make sure it's properly staffed. It's also urgent because to the extent that some days it may feel like there's proper staffing, it's because they're working people an insane amount of overtime. That also makes for a very dangerous situation. When I, as president of the NAACP, successfully promoted criminal justice reform nationally and worked with governors in states like Georgia and bipartisan leaders in states like Texas to get big reforms through, we did it with the support of corrections officers, just like I'm running in this campaign with the support of their union. Why? Frankly, as an NAACP leader, I've spent a lot more time in prisons than anybody else running for office, talking to COs, listening to COs, and I understand that part of ending mass incarceration means creating a better working environment for the officers where they don't have to work overtime, and quite frankly, where the prisons aren't as fraught with dangers because inmates aren't overcrowded, too. So there's a lot we can do, but it starts with making sure that we end the mandatory overtime at ECI by properly staffing it. This governor has short-staffed across social workers, probation officers, corrections officers. If you look at what's happened to state employees under Mr. Hogan, he essentially extended the recession 4 years for them. Most of our state employees, including the correction officers, are making 15% to 20% less than they should be right now. And so there's a lot to be done, but it starts with making sure that we stop the understaffing in critical areas like ECI.
Just briefly, in terms of those people who are getting out, who are in prison, are getting out, yeah, what kind of assistance do you think is necessary there? I've talked
houses
of
corrections.
Yeah.
Houses of corrections should be houses of corrections. That means that people should be coming out more literate than they went in. We have a lot of inmates. I've been to facilities where in our country where they say 75% of the inmates are too illiterate to read a McDonald's menu. Well, if you can't read the menu, you cannot work at McDonald's. And so we're literally committing a crime against ourselves, not just the inmate, when we allow them to come back illiterate, because they're going to most likely break another law and end back in prison, because how can you support yourself if you can't read? So we need to make sure that everybody in prison learns to read. We need to make sure everybody there comes out with more skills than they went in, better prepared to really get traction in our economy as a productive citizen and provide for their family. We need to make sure that they come out in rehabilitation if they went in addicted, and they certainly don't come out more addicted. And we need to do everything we can to create an environment in which they stay in touch with family and are able to maintain strong ties to community. At the same time, we need to make sure that there's greater opportunities for the officers and their families to get access to education. And to, my family was lifted out of poverty because my grandfather was in law enforcement. He was a probation officer. So I'm also fully committed to making sure that we make our community colleges tuition free and that anybody who wants to train to be a first responder or a teacher, for example, is able to go to our universities tuition free, our public universities, and that will be made possible over time by reducing our inmate population in a sustainable way, in the ways that I mentioned, and frankly, lowering recidivism, making sure that fewer people come back, and as you do that over time, the prison system shrinks.
We have a situation where we have obviously agriculture and the poultry industry, but we also have environmental concerns, particularly the Bay. How do you balance those two interests?
We have to sit down. I just came off the board of the Environmental Defense Fund when I started this run, and we work more closely with corporations. We work more closely with the agricultural sector, with farmers, with watermen than perhaps any other environmental group. And one of the things that we succeeded at was just getting everybody in a room and putting all the interests on the table. You know, ultimately, a waterman has an interest in a sustainable crop that their children and future generations will be able to harvest. And farmers have an interest in land that will not become poisoned and that will always be productive. And we all have both an interest in adapting to climate change and fighting it. And so we've got to put that on the table. We cannot let this be sort of partisan politics where people are pitted against each other. You know, our planet continues to become less stable and less able to sustainably support human life. And we cannot really tolerate economies, even local economies, continuing to languish and people to feel financially stuck. And so, again, the best way to do that is you pull everybody together, you put all the interests on the table, you focus on making one change we can all agree on, you come back to the table, you make another change, and over time you build trust, you rebuild community, and we start moving forward together faster.
Where are you, by the way, on the offshore wind farms, where there's some strong opposition in many ways from the Ocean City folks because they're concerned about tourism? Obviously, there's an environmental concern. Are you for against them?
Yeah. I'm for. I split my childhood between West Baltimore and a coastal community in California where my parents live. And I certainly understand. I grew up in a town of 15,000 people. The mayor of Cambridge, you know, compared it to Cambridge. It's an old fishing community. And I get the aesthetic concerns. I believe that they have been overplayed, quite frankly, with dollars from the traditional energy industries trying to foment discord so they can hold on to the status quo. Let's be clear. The status quo in energy production is threatening every coastal community on the planet with sea level rise. And so those of us who love coastal communities, who are part of coastal communities, who grew up in them, as I spent much of my childhood, I need to have the courage to say we have to do everything we can to stop sea level rise. And in Maryland, that means shifting to wind production. We can do it in a way that once they're up, you know, frankly, they may be a curiosity, but they will not be anything that discourages anybody from coming down and enjoying the beaches of the Eastern Shore of Ocean City, as my family does. And more importantly, they will bring thousands upon thousands upon thousands of jobs to the region. And that's important. Because we need more jobs for our young people. We need more technical employment for our young people where they can see a way to advance in their careers. We should be building turbines in Dundalk and floating them right down the bay and installing them off the Eastern Shore.
In terms of transportation, under Governor Hogan, we've seen some repaving of the bypass. We've seen a lot of concern in terms of road building, that kind of thing. And one of the questions will be, why should we have somebody, say, like yourself, as opposed to, say, Larry Hogan, who seems to spend a lot of time in the rural areas? In other words, it's almost big city versus rural areas.
He certainly wanted to feel that way. Hogan's politics is pitting regions of the state against each other. It's bad politics. It makes for even worse policy. I've traveled to every state. You know, as president of the NAACP, and I brought a similar approach in my campaign for governor. I've traveled to every county in my campaign multiple times. And when you listen to families, what you see is that most of our concerns are similar. You know, that people are worried that our public universities are too expensive. They're worried that our public schools and the children in them are falling behind. They're worried about the local economy being stuck. And they're worried about high healthcare costs. So I've run a campaign really focused on the kitchen table issue, and they're worried about the opioid crisis that Larry Hogan ignored for 2 years. Thousands of our neighbors died. And so we focus on those common kitchen table issues, and you find that we have more in common, as a man said to me the other day, than we have uncommon. That our state really, there's a lot of agreement on priorities. At the same time, we have to recognize that there is a real need for public transportation, even in areas where people drive primarily because we're in rural areas. You know, I just got my 19-year-old nephew out of my basement. It felt like graduation day for me. And a lot of the people who are campaigning for my campaign, the Eastern Shore, are young people. And a lot of them feel stuck by the lack of public transportation. So, you know what? I got a job in Ocean City. I got a job in Salisbury, but I live outside. And, you know, if I could get to my job, I'd be able to buy a car, but I can't get to my job because there's no public transportation that can actually get me to my job on time and get me home reliably. So what do you do with that? Well, you look at the future and you say, look, if we right now have on-demand technology in private transportation, I'm talking about Uber, for example, where, you know, if you can press a button, a car will come to you, but, you know, no young person working for minimum wage could afford to use it. Why can't we take that on-demand technology into public transportation, put it into public vans on the Eastern Shore, where workers can be moved point to point? You know, we have to recognize that public transportation is not just an urban issue, and quite frankly, bad roads are not just a rural issue. We need to have good roads everywhere, and we need to have good public transportation everywhere. Governor Hogan likes to pit people against each other. I like to find the common ground so we can all move forward.
You don't think that there's a tension then between large, the urban areas as opposed to rural areas?
I mean, I don't think that there needs to be. I mean, Bob Ehrlich was...
I mean,
was,
in terms of money alone, right?
Yeah,
they either go money for a purple line or money for the...
It doesn't need to be. Politicians do that because as Bob Ehrlich said a long time ago, bashing Baltimore is good politics. Well, Larry Hogan's too smart to say it, but he sure as heck acts like it. And that doesn't make any sense, you know, because then what do you do? Somebody's supposed to run for office and say, well, I'm going to defend this area against that area. No, the people of the state aren't, you know, want to see everywhere move forward. People understand that the Eastern Shore is, you know, a jewel of the state. From a tourism perspective, it's the heart of the state. From an agricultural perspective, it's the pride of the state with all of its universities. It's a wonderful place. And you know what? Baltimore's a wonderful place, too. And together, they make Maryland a wonderful place. And we have to approach our state in that respect and sit down and say, you know what? We need to have a transportation plan for the entire state that takes everybody's needs into account, and then celebrate when we make victories for any part of the state, because we're ultimately lifting up the state. You know, our children oftentimes connect the state because they grew up one place and they move somewhere else, or they grew up one place and they study somewhere else. They see Maryland as one beautiful place, and we as adults should be willing to see it that way, too.
In terms of your political party, you've been endorsed by Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and so on.
And Obama and Biden and right. Liz Warren. Yep.
And you've been seen as representing that part of the party. How do you bring the party together?
Well, when you put Joe Biden, Barbara Mikulski, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Ben Cardin, Chris Van Hollen, every Democratic congressional person, all into one pot. That's the entire Democratic Party right there. I ran as somebody who had endorsed Bernie Sanders in the primary, and then in 2016, I endorsed Hillary Clinton in the general. I was the first Bernie delegate to endorse Hillary Clinton. And I did it with a whole heart because I understand, one, she would have been a heck of a lot better than Donald Trump, and two, she was a great leader with a great heart, with a historic run, and we deserved her to be our president as much as she deserved to be president. And yet, you know, many people want to pretend like we are not one party. But when I look at our party, I see that, you know, in Maryland, I see the party that Barbara Mikulski built. And my grandma, a long time ago, helped train a young social worker named Barbara Mikulski. And those two ladies in my life remind me, this is one party. It's a big party. What unites all of us is our commitment to fight for working people.
Finally, you've probably noticed there are a lot of Trump signs around the Eastern Shore.
Yep.
You've obviously been a sharp critic of the president.
Yes.
What do you say to those people? And do you think the president should be impeached, for that matter?
Well,
what do you say to them?
My feelings about Donald Trump are certainly very different than my feelings about Trump voters. Yes, I do think Donald Trump should be impeached. There are multiple grounds for his impeachment, beginning with obstruction of justice and his firing of FBI Director Comey and his perpetual threats against other senior leaders in the FBI. I have family members in the FBI. I have family members, you know, who live in Maryland. I have family members in federal law enforcement in Maryland. My family's been in law enforcement in Maryland for over a half century. And when I see a president of the United States dismiss an FBI director because the president's afraid of the investigation against the president, that's grounds for impeachment. With regards to folks who voted for Trump, it's a very different story. Now, I was in a backyard in Talbot County, and a man raised his hand. He said, Mr. Jealous, what do you think of Trump voters? And I said, sir, given that we're in a yard with like 100 Democrats, I'm assuming you mean people who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump? He said, yeah, them. I said, well, I don't think that they're crazy, if that's what you mean. I saw the polls. And the polls said that folks who voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump felt left behind in this economy, and then they tried something new. I said, similarly, I think, you know, black voters who voted twice for Obama and didn't vote, well, they aren't crazy either. Because the polls showed that they tended to feel left behind in the economy, too. One group tended to be black, the other group tended to be white. Both felt left behind the economy. One tried something else, voting for Trump. One just didn't do it again. I said to him, let's be clear. I spent a year of my life, you know, as a black guy with a white dad and a white uncle who was torn between voting for Trump and voting for Bernie Sanders, trying to convince both groups to do something else. But I said, I will never disparage them because this is a free country and people sometimes they try something and then they try something else or they don't do it again. He said, well, thank you for that grace. He said, because I voted for Donald Trump. He said, I have one other question for you, sir. I said, what's that? He said, where are you on Medicare for All? I said, I'm 100% for it. He said, what if the federal government won't do it? I said, well, I'm pretty sure Donald Trump won't. He said, yeah, I don't think he will either. He said, well, what are you on the state level? I said, I'm all for it. I'll fight for it every day because 350,000 of our neighbors don't have health care. It's the number one cause of bankruptcy. And quite frankly, all of us could be getting a better deal. And he said, great. He said, I'll vote for you. I said, hold on. You voted for Donald Trump, and now you're going to be voting for the former president of the NAACP as your governor. I said, why? He said, well, it's pretty simple, sir. I am a finance manager at a car dealership. My bottom line is my business and my people. Neither one of them get healthier. Neither one of them gets stronger until we get healthcare costs under control. And I only see one candidate in this race who's willing to fight for Medicare for All, so I'll organize for you. And so with Trump voters, I've always approached them with an open heart and a desire to talk frankly about how we all move forward together. You know, a lot of the struggles you see in one color in our state, you see in a different color somewhere else. And I come from a family where, you know, I have one uncle who helped to inspire me as a kid, who's a black businessman from Prince George's County and Baltimore City, different parts of his life. And I have another uncle who runs a lumber yard in a rural community. And both of them helped make me who I am. And I want folks like both of them to have good, effective leadership that's courageous enough to fight against the pharmaceutical companies. And that's why I'm proud to be the only candidate in this race who's not taking money from the pharmaceutical companies, and the only one in this race who's taking them on.
We've been speaking with Ben Jealous. He is a Democratic candidate for governor in the state of Maryland, running against the incumbent Republican, Larry Hogan. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you. It's a real joy to be here.
We did reach out to Governor Larry Hogan's campaign, but they did not respond. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. Most expect incumbent Maryland Democratic Senator Ben Cardin to win this year's election. But there's an independent candidate, and you may have even seen his TV ads. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. His name is Neil Simon, the 50-year-old CEO of an investment and wealth management firm who has put more than $500,000 into his campaign. He's also facing Republican nominee Tony Campbell. What makes the race interesting is a public opinion poll by Gonzales Research and Media Services, which found Cardin with just under 50%. Republican pulled in 21%, with Simon coming in at around 18%. The poll also found that 54% would consider an unaffiliated candidate. We spoke with him late last month about his candidacy and the issues. Why did you decide to run for the Senate?
So like so many Americans, I have been frustrated with the bad results we get from our government and with the divisiveness that comes out of Washington, D.C. And I decided to run, one, to try to bring this country together rather than pull us apart. Two, to try to do something to help people in Maryland get ahead and put the people in Maryland ahead of any political party. I think we've got political leaders who are being pulled more and more to two extremes and representing parties rather than the people of Maryland. And then three, I'm running unaffiliated from any political party, and I'm doing it to try to change the way Washington works in a way that you can only do without a party label next to your name.
So looking at the public opinion polls, I mean, Cardin is just below, I think, 50% is what I saw. You're coming up with about 18% or more. But you still have a long ways to go, and you could split the vote, and Carter could still win.
So we are at the last poll had us about 18%, and Cardin had gone from 56 to 49. So we're still behind, but we've got a lot of upward momentum. The poll 3 weeks before that, we were at only 8%. And I think the American public and the people of Maryland, as I've traveled around Maryland on, I will tell you there's so much enthusiasm for anything other than what we've got. People are just so tired of the partisanship and the divisiveness and the political brawl that we witness every day. I think the Kavanaugh hearings highlighted that for people. Whether you thought he should be confirmed or not, I think so many of us were just embarrassed by the behavior of our Senate. Senate used to be the world's greatest deliberative body, and it has descended, sadly, into a political circus. And it is just behaving like two tribes going to battle every day rather than a group of people working together on behalf of the American people.
Do you consider Senator Cardin in that group?
I do. He votes with his party leader 97% of the time, and more than with any other senator. He is one of the most reliable partisan votes. And I think what we need is people are going to put the people of Maryland ahead of any political party. And what we see is party line vote after party line vote. There are 12 states where you have one senator from each of the two major parties. And on almost every single issue, they're voting on opposite sides. And they represent the same exact people. And they're voting on the same bills, but yet voting constantly with their parties rather than with the people of their states. And I think the American public is tired of it, and we're starting to all see through the narrative every day. I hear this from people. They no longer trust in our government has descended. There was a poll that came out yesterday that showed the trust in our government dropped 13 points to only 30%. And I know there are people on the right who like to blame that all on the left, and there are people on the left who like to blame it all on the right, but it's the behavior of both parties that collectively and incrementally have led to the disintegration of the trust that the American people have in our government. And I think that's a tragedy. It's a tragedy that we have a generation of people growing up who will not trust our government the way we did when we grew up.
So who would you caucus with, or would you caucus with somebody? I mean, we have, for instance, Senator Bernie Sanders, who is an independent, but he caucuses, for instance, with the Democrats.
Right. So there are right now two independent senators, U.S. Senators Bernie Sanders and Angus King, and they both caucus with the Democrats. There's also, by the way, an independent governor, Bill Walker, in Alaska. I would not caucus with either party. And the parties argue that you have to. You do not have to. We've had lawyers look into this extensively. I've spoken personally with the former Senate parliamentarian at length about this issue, and you do not have to. So what it would mean is that the people of Maryland would have the most powerful Senate seat there is on every issue, rather than my vote being taken for granted by one party or the other. They've got to come to us. And they got to say, where do you stand on this? And I stand with the people of Maryland, and I will vote based upon what's in the best interest of the people of Maryland, not a political party. And then the parties sometimes argue that, well, if you don't caucus with one party or the other, then you're not going to get committee assignments. And that's also not true. And so the people forget there are no political parties in our Constitution. Our founding fathers envisioned a government where you would have representatives of the people who came to Washington to represent their constituents for a number of years and then went back to what they did. And they did not envision a system that was taken over by political parties. In fact, a number of them feared what we have today. George Washington, even in his farewell address, wrote that his greatest fear was that Americans would develop more loyalty to their party than they had to the country. And sadly, I think we've gotten to that point, particularly with our representatives. So you don't have to caucus with either party, and I would not.
So turning to some issues, health care, which is apparently front and center in this election, certainly. You say, of course, that the Affordable Care Act was a good first step. You talk about one of the basic problems was the rising cost of healthcare in itself, and you want to emphasize quality over quantity. How do you do that? And I mean, do you need to legislate that into existence?
So healthcare is an example of an issue where you've got the parties that dig into fairly extreme positions and nothing gets done. So we've got the Democratic leadership more and more arguing for essentially socialized medicine, the government operating our healthcare system. And I don't personally believe in that, and I think all the data suggests it would add trillions of dollars of expense to our federal government. And I don't think that's the best way for us to have the best healthcare system in the world. At the same time, you've got Republican leaders that tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act with no replacement, and that would leave millions of people uninsured. And it would also bring back a day and age when we had bad plans that where people thought they were covered, but they weren't really covered for a number of things, and you had lots of people being forced into bankruptcy because of health care costs. And I do believe that America should be a country where everyone's got basic health care. I ran a number of businesses, and I've provided health care to hundreds of people, and I think that is a basic right of Americans. So what I think we need to do at this point is stop arguing about how to pay for our really inefficient system. So what the parties are doing are basically arguing about how to pay for a really inefficient system. We spend double what the average industrialized country spends on healthcare. So we spend 18% of our GDP. The average country spends 9%. And what we need to do is stop arguing about how to pay for that and start thinking about how do we provide health care to everyone in the most efficient way we can so we can get, rather than let that 18% go up to 20%, which is what we're on track to do, we can get that back down to a more manageable level where we're spending less and it costs American families less and it costs small businesses less, and focus on the things that we can do to make that happen.
I guess the question is, how do you get the costs down? What do you do? Right.
So there, I think the parts of our healthcare system that work the best now are the parts where we incentivize wellness rather than incentivizing more of everything. So, for example, in Maryland, 30% of our healthcare costs in Maryland are our hospital system. And that part of our healthcare system here in Maryland works pretty well. And it's unique in the country. And a lot of your listeners might not be aware of this, but the way the hospital system works, this is, when you simplify it, is that each hospital system is compensated based upon the population that they serve. So they get a certain amount of money based on the population that they serve. And we started this a few years ago, and it completely altered the behavior of the hospital system. So I've met with the management teams of 5 of the 8 largest hospital systems in Maryland. And when you talk to them about how that changed, in the past, they had been incentivized with P&Ls, profit and loss statements, and where the more activity that happened, the more revenue that would come in. So the more tests that happened, the more procedures, the more visits to doctors, and that incentivizes a certain type of behavior where you're doing more of everything. The change we made a few years ago was that now they're incentivized for wellness. So you've got, I talked to the CEO of one hospital system where he said, you know, we pay for people to go make home visits now to patients who have been here for dialysis because we want to make sure they're doing the right thing so they don't end up right back in our hospital 3 weeks later to get dialysis again. So their hospitals are now proactively making that investment in wellness. I was in another hospital system where they showed me their wellness center, and they've got 5 full-time employees that are there to counsel patients who are coming in there about everything from diets and exercise and follow-up procedures when they come in to the hospital. So we're incentivizing wellness. And as a result, we have saved billions of dollars. So that works well. Another example is the way Kaiser Permanente works, where you combine the insurance aspect of healthcare with the delivery of healthcare. And you, again, start incentivizing wellness rather than incentivizing more of everything. So anything we can do as a country to get away from incentivizing more tests, more procedures, more visits, more of everything, the better off we are. That's the single biggest difference between our country and other countries in terms of the driver of cost, is that we do more of all those things compared to other medical systems around the world.
Turning to immigration, obviously front and center with the caravan coming up from Central America. You've said that you certainly want secure borders as well as perhaps citizenship for Dreamers, or at least that's what it indicates. How would you deal with those twin issues? And it seems as if one negates the other as we try to get through anything through Congress.
Sure. So this was a issue during the debate. I encourage your listeners to watch the debate if they didn't see it when it was televised. Then it's available on C-SPAN. But immigration is another issue. You've got the parties have dug into extreme positions and nothing's gotten done. And it's been in the public discourse for over a decade now. And we need desperately comprehensive immigration reform. And when I talk to people, I think people think that this is an issue where we should be able to compromise and get it done. So I do advocate for additional border security. We have 500,000 people a year coming into this country illegally, while millions of people around the world are waiting to do it legally. And that's not fair to those people waiting around the world. And we should be a nation with a secure border. So I do advocate for additional border security and spending the money necessary to do that. At the same time, I think that if people have been here for decades, and they, especially if they came as children under DACA or TPS, that we should create a path for them to citizenship, and I think most Americans agree with that. And I also believe that we should not be separating families, and that American values are to keep a mother with her 5-year-old child. So the party should be able to compromise and get this done. Add additional border security. Let's get that number down from 500,000 as low as possible, as close to zero as possible. And let's also then treat fairly the people who are here and have been here for a long time and are law-abiding and tax-paying and create a path to citizenship. The parties, sadly, dig in to extreme positions. Neither one of them wants to give the other party a win, and nothing gets done. So I think this is an issue where if you have a leader in our legislative branch who doesn't have a D or an R next to their name and proposes some kind of moderate legislation, maybe we can finally get something done on this issue.
Turning to what you call fiscal responsibility, we have a rising debt. It looks like it's going to continue to rise with the recent tax cuts. There's now discussion about cutting programs like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, that kind of thing. What would you do to get us on the track? And does that mean that we might see some cuts in those programs?
So the debt is an important issue. It's hard to get people to really appreciate how important this is, but we now have $21 trillion of debt. It's $160,000 per household. And at some point in the future, that's going to impact us, right? The next generation is going to either not have the same social services that we enjoy today or not have the same military strength that we enjoy today, because so much of the federal revenue is going to have to be used to be paying off this debt. So this is a hugely important issue. Yet neither party can claim that they are at all fiscally responsible anymore. I think that both parties at moments could claim that, but they've both given up entirely, and neither party has any courage to address this issue and to say no to any of the special interests that fight for funding. And it's, I think, completely unfair to the next generation. And when I talk to young voters, I talk about this all the time, because nobody is looking out for them, and nobody's looking out for today's children and the next generation's children. And it just is getting worse and worse. So when you're in a hole, the first rule is stop digging, but our government keeps digging. So just in the last year, we had the tax cut bill, which there were parts of that I was in favor of and parts that I wasn't, but it added $1.5 trillion to our debt. And then you had the spending bill, which both parties voted for, and that added $1.5 trillion to the debt. And where are the government leaders that are going to stand up? There were one or two who stood up during the spending bill, but almost nobody had the courage to stand up. So the first rule is you got to stop digging. So I would have voted against that spending bill. And
the tax bill?
Excuse me?
And the tax bill? What about that?
The tax bill, I'll tell you what I would have done on that, is I would have fought for the people of Maryland. So the tax bill did add a lot to the debt. I did support the decrease in the corporate tax rate, and I think that's contributed to our low unemployment and economic growth right now. I didn't think it had to go as far as it did because it added so much to the debt. I think the income tax deductions for the working class should have been permanent. But the real shortcoming is that the people of Maryland got adversely impacted by that because they limited the deduction of state and local income taxes. And 30% of the people in Maryland are paying more in taxes than they were before the quote-unquote tax cut. And what did our representatives do? They did nothing. They sat on their hands, and they believed that it was going to fail because the Republicans had failed a few months earlier to get the health care bill through, and the Democrats thought that the tax bill wasn't going to get through either. So rather than fight for the people of Maryland and say, listen, leave in that deduction that helps the people of Maryland and maybe make one or two other changes and you can get our vote, that's what I would have done. Rather than do that, they just rooted for failure. They did not work on behalf of the people of Maryland. And I know this because I went down to Capitol Hill and I spoke to one of the Democratic aides and I said, why are you guys not proposing an alternative? And they said, well, we don't want to give them a win. We don't want to give the Republicans a win. And my question for your listeners is, what kind of representation is that? That's just political games that we're all so tired of. It's all about party wins, and it's not about representing constituents.
Well, along these lines, so the question becomes, though, if you cut taxes, you cut revenue, and inevitably then you talk about cutting programs. It's just self-fulfilling. So if you'd have, do you see any tax increases at all to make up for the shortfall?
I do not. I think that what we need to do is, you know, with the best map for all of this was Simpson-Bowles. So Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles were appointed about 10 years ago to put together a bipartisan commission to address our debt and deficit. And there were 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans, including a number of sitting senators and congressmen, and they came up with a set of recommendations. And it addressed everything from military spending to discretionary spending to entitlements. And it was a set of really thoughtful recommendations. And sadly, what our leadership did at the time was basically toss it to the side and do nothing with it. And I think there's a pretty good blueprint there. It involves dealing with all aspects of our government. There's not a quick silver bullet. I think we, for example, you know, the military, we need to have the strongest military in the world. And we just increased military spending by $80 billion a year. And the military got pretty much everything they wanted. I think we can think now about slowing the rate of growth of the military spending. Same with our social service programs. You know, I think as much as what we need to do is just slowing the growth of our spending. We just keep spending more and more and more and more.
And turning to guns, you talk a lot about certainly supporting background checks, emphasis on mental illness, for example, the red flag law, of course, Munchausen, and so on. Those are all issues that have been on the table. Democrats certainly have supported those, but they've often been killed, and mostly it seems by the National Rifle Association in terms of its opposition to a number of these kinds of measures, particularly background checks. How do you break that juggernaut?
I think the way you break the juggernaut is you focus on where there's common ground. And this is another issue where the parties dig into extremes. And I don't think it's only the right that's digging into extremes. And nothing's gotten done, right? It's been 19 years since Columbine, and nothing's gotten done. So the thing we know is that the approach we're taking today is not working, right? This approach of just taking an extreme position and screaming louder and louder at the other side is not getting us anywhere. So I focus on where there's common ground, and I think it's 3 areas. It's universal background checks, which is preventing criminals and terrorists from getting weapons, and right now 20% of gun sales nationally circumvent that, and we need to stop that. Second is preventing people who are in a volatile mental state from getting weapons, which is adding a mental health component to the background checks. And we got to do it carefully and protect privacy, but it's important, and we need to do that. And then the third is bump stocks, like the one used in the Las Vegas shooting, which I talked to a NRA member, former Army Ranger, who is a devout gun rights activist, and he said, you know, I can live without bump stocks. They're not accurate. I don't need them to defend myself, and you just use it to spray. And those 3 things are supported by 83% of Americans or more. So that's where the common ground is. And I think if everyone focused on those three issues, we actually might get something done. But when the left starts digging in and wants to raise the age and use fingerprint technology and ban lots of weapons, the right digs in and says, we're not doing any of that because that's taking away our guns. And then nothing gets done. And so my question on this issue is always, I ask people on the left, I say, listen, wouldn't you rather have these three things than nothing? And I say to people on the right, can you live with these three things? And they both say yes. And that's how you get things done. You focus on finding common ground. But both parties like to use this issue, like many other issues, to demonize the other side, to pull into extreme positions, to throw red meat at their bases and energize their bases. And they're more interested in that and winning elections than they are actually getting anything done on this. So I think we've been failed by our leaders. It's costing lives. And I think that it's not just one side. It's the partisanship and the extreme leadership that we've got that are causing us to get nothing done on this and the other issues you brought up.
You seem to be sort of portraying yourself as a moderate. Is that a fair description of your approach?
I think it is. You know, my focus is the same as the way I ran my companies, right? My last business, we had 100 people, lots of advanced degrees, lots of super smart people with different ideas. And my job, as much as anything, was to form consensus, find common ground, get things done. And we need people in the Senate who are going to take that approach. The idea, we just seem to have a legislative branch that is full of people who believe that the answer to our nation's problems is screaming louder at the other side. And I don't know what your life experience has done, but generally screaming louder at the other side is not how you get things done. It might make you feel good for that moment. It might energize people around you, but you're not going to get anything done. And we need to get out of this vicious cycle. I closed the debate by talking about the current era and how I think the history books will write about this era and call it partisanship and divisiveness. And the readers of those history books are going to look at this era and wonder, how do we let this happen? How do we let ourselves have a government that got so little done but did so much to divide us and pull us apart? And we, I think, are starved for leaders who are going to bring us together and focus on getting things done on behalf of the American people. And we all are looking for those leaders, and we need to get out of this vicious cycle that we're in.
Just briefly, we only have a minute or two left. What do you make of what seems to be the toxic political atmosphere that we seem to have now moved into?
I think it is toxic, and it's sad to me. It's sad to me that we've got a generation of children growing up watching leaders who lie, who belittle, who attack the press, who attack anyone who's critical of them. You know, when I grew up under President Carter, President Reagan. They were very different politically, but we all believe they were good people who were trying to do good for the American public, and we believe that they were trustworthy and honest. And I think we got a generation of people who have grown up looking at our government leaders not feeling any of that and feeling like our elected officials care more about their own careers and being in office for 50 years and winning the next election and raising money and winning the argument and winning the news cycle for the day than they do actually care about the American people. And it's not so. You asked about the debt earlier. We're leaving the next generation with that debt. You asked about immigration, which we're leaving unresolved for the next generation. You asked about health care, which we're leaving them with massive health care costs. We're also leaving them with a government that is not just dysfunctional, but that people don't trust anymore. And it is really sad to me that a generation of children are growing up being left with all those problems. And who is fighting for them? Who is fighting for them? I want to fight for those people. I want to not fight for Chuck Schumer or Mitch McConnell, but I want to fight for the people in Maryland and the next generation who's being left with all those issues.
Neil Simon, an independent candidate running against Maryland Democratic Senator Ben Cardin and Republican nominee Tony Campbell. We did reach out to Senator Ben Cardin's campaign, but they did not respond. This is Don Rush for Delmarva Public Radio.